The Copywriter Club podcast is sponsored by AirStory, the writing platform for professional writers who want to get more done in half the time. Learn more at airstory.co/club.
What if you could hang out with seriously talented copywriters and other experts, ask them about their successes and failures, their work processes, and their habits, then steal an idea or two to inspire your own work? That's what Rob and I do every week at the Copywriter Club podcast.
You're invited to join the club for episode 42 as we chat with Casey Slaughter Stanton about how single proprietors like copywriters can better market themselves, improving the sales process, creating client proposals that clients say yes to, and what he calls city dating.
Hey, Casey. Hey, Rob. How's it going?
Guys.
Hey, great. Great. Great to be on, y'all.
Casey, a really great place to start would be with your story, since most of our audience has not heard of you before. So let's start there.
Sure. So back in 2008, I graduated from Michigan State University with a bachelor's degree in environmental policy. And when I say graduated, I just did the air quotes because I had to plead to my Native American music professor to actually give me a D minus in the class. And I think he gave me a D. He even threw me a bone there. So I graduated somehow, and I was pretty shocked, and I hit the workforce, and I was looking for jobs immediately after school, thinking that I could get into a sales role, and what I found was that unemployment was a real big issue, and I watched the unemployment stats go from 5% to 6% to 7% to 8% to 9%. While I was still looking for a job, they topped out at 10.5%, and I was screwed because I had no real experience in anything, and environmental policy kind of meant I could only work in Lansing, and I just couldn't survive there. So what I was forced to do was move back home with my parents, and I took the basement over and picked up a job mowing lawns and spent the whole summer on the back of a lawnmower trying to figure out what I was going to do. And lucky for me, I was able to grab a couple Tony Robbins tapes from the library, found a bunch of resources online, and just started listening and learning and just, you know, overloading my brain with different ideas and seeing, you know, what was out there. I was mowing lawns at a guy's place. His name was Dave, and he had this beautiful house, and he just really was like living the good life. Every time I saw him, he was like having a Mai Tai or you know, like a tea out on his deck overlooking the bay. And so I asked him one day, I said, "Hey, Dave, how'd you do it? You know, how did you get to be so successful that you could afford a place like this?" And he said, "Well, Casey, I invented a product and got it patented, and I have a group of distributors that sell it." And I said, I want to do it, man. I want to live this life. He said, "Well, you can buy some of the products and you can go ahead and sell them." I said, "Could you front me? I'm a little short on cash." He said, "No, I can't." So a few weeks later, I'd saved enough money up and I bought 10 products of his and went door to door and I sold a couple and I made more money that first day of selling door to door in less time than I did in a week of mowing the lawns. And I knew that selling was something that I was just naturally good at. Being a millennial, and kind of growing up with the internet, I said to myself, like, there's got to be an easier way than going door to door. So I looked online and I talked to one of my dad's friends who was in marketing, and he said, "Oh, that's marketing. So you're doing sales, and if you want to multiply that, that's marketing." So that definition of marketing is salesmanship multiplied really fit in here. And that's where I got started in marketing and started selling products online, finding local clients, doing copywriting and marketing and technology implementation for them. I ran that for a few years, met up with a guy named Mike Klein, who has a business, Tech Guys Who Get Marketing. And it's kind of a collective of technologists and marketers and copywriters and designers. And we all work together to support clients. And I was working with them, became the chief marketing officer there, and later went on to become a marketing professor at Tulane University. Again, with a bachelor's of science in environmental policy, I was teaching at a business school, marketing, and all of my education has been through spending time in other people's businesses and learning about what they do and how they do it and just taking that and creatively applying it to different places.
Casey, what you're doing now then is a lot more than just selling a couple of products, right?
What I've done is I've created my own strategy in marketing, which I call functional marketing and functional sales and functional teams. And it's kind of the trifecta of what I've had the most experience in and the things that I found that really move the needle in a business the most. So functional marketing looks at a business at large and says, what happened in the past? What assets do you have? What marketing campaigns worked and didn't work? What assets do you have? What mailing lists? You know, what favors are owed to you? What's your unique ability, to use a strategic coach term? And really figuring out the history of a business. And then from that, I say, okay, where do we want to be in 90 days or 2 years? And they give me ideas, and then I help them get more solidified goals. And then I lay out strategies and different marketing tests that are more holistic in the business to help them achieve the results that they want in 90 days and in 2 years. So I work really with clients for 90 days at a time, and we just keep going and going. And in 2 years, we aim to hit that 2-year goal. So that's the approach that I take. And I need technologists, and that's the tech guys who get marketing team. I can pull in the techs there and project managers so they can support me on places that I'm incredibly weak. You know, I don't want to be a good project manager. I want to be the best marketing strategist. And that's what having a team of other people allows me to do.
So Casey, I want to get into functional marketing and your business. But before that, I want to go back to when you were selling door to door. You know, I want to know what made you that great salesperson. You know, what did you have at that stage? Or what can you advise us to do? Because we're all selling, whether or not we're door to door or selling through online copy. What can we do better?
Great question. So ultimately, sales is a one-to-one human interaction. And it's about understanding who you're talking to and fitting the product or service to them. And not trying to say to a huge crowd of people, this is the one product for you. What I like to do is to sell individually. And whenever I sell face-to-face, if I sell on a sales call, I just had a big sales call before this call, and it was me talking to one person. Or if I'm going to sell a product online, I'm still only selling to one person. It may be that there's a multitude of those people. There might be hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of those prospects that are online that might see the offer, but I'm still just selling to the one individual at a time. I don't like to use you guys or, you know, group people together. I'd like to look at what makes people unique and different. I'm confident that that's the thing that has made me so successful in sales, is identifying who the person is, making empathy guesses. And that's an idea that comes from Dr. Marshall Rosenberg and his work on nonviolent communication. So he says, take a guess, and like an empathetic guess on how the person's feeling and why they're feeling that way, and really kind of clue into that, and then talk through their experience in the world and how your product or service can solve that problem. And I think that that's just made a huge difference in me being connected to the person. And that necessitates that we as marketers, copywriters, business owners, that we actually believe in the product that we're selling. Because I can't in good faith sell to someone and try to solve a problem that they have with a product that won't solve the problem. So knowing that you can believe in the product that you have, and that was my first problem with the door-to-door sales, and I quickly dropped that product because I realized that it actually wasn't a great product, and I had to move on to other things. That's just been a huge differentiation, I think, in selling effectively.
So let's talk a little bit more deeply about that sales process. I think you've talked in the past about how you use the DOS to get to know a customer in order to, you know, help solve their problem. Walk us through that process.
What I love to do on a sales call is really have someone else tell me what the problem is. And I like to poke in, and I like to get the emotional words from it. I want to know how they feel. I was just on a sales call with someone, and she's big in the health space. And at the end of the call, I said, what's robbing you of your confidence? What keeps you up at night? The question I like to ask is, what are you worried about before you go to bed or when you're in the shower all by yourself? Like, what are those moments of frustration? And if I can get clarity on what those are, I can solve them. So that's me selling a service. And I know my functional marketing strategy is going to be effective for this business, but it's only as effective as I understand the problems to be. So if they limit the problems that they tell me, I can only solve the problems I know. So I have to ask a lot of questions. Similarly, I like to poke in and ask really personal questions. When someone says something to me like, oh yeah, that's frustrating, I say, how is that frustrating? And how does that frustration manifest itself? Do you have reduced confidence in your team? Do you feel like you're not going to be able to make payroll? What does that feel like? What's that like? And really getting into the emotions of it, I can sell people on the emotion. Because at the end of the day, everyone buys because of emotion. And the way I learned it was, we buy based on emotion, but we have to have enough logic to be able to defend our choice to our spouse. In the heat of the moment at the point of sale, we're always buying because emotionally we feel like, oh, life's going to be so much better and I'm going to feel so relieved once this solution's in place. So it's important to really play into that emotion side and, you know, not spend too much time just on the logic.
So what does that look like in more detail when you're asking those questions? Are you pulling those questions before you even get on a sales call? And maybe you have an online form that they're filling out, and then you have that information so you know exactly what direction to go when you get on a call with them?
No, I don't really have a ton of information.
Okay.
So in one of our businesses, we call it Engaged Officers. It's an outsourced chief marketing and chief technology officer kind of suite that we provide. We launched that at Genius Network's annual event 2 years ago. And on our table, we just said, I'm a tech guy and I'm a marketer. My colleague Bill is a great technologist and I'm a marketer. So we said, I'm a marketer, I'm a tech guy. Let us solve your problems related to marketing and tech. And we had a marketing and tech audit is what we called it. And people would sign up and then we sent them a questionnaire and then booked a call. And we would ask them questions about what's the biggest result you've delivered for a client? What's your Colby? How successful has your business been in the last 12 months? What's your goal for 2 years out from today? Do you have any on-staff marketers or technologists? Some basic questions to kind of guide the conversation. But then when I get on the call, I ask really personal questions. And I ask questions sometimes on the first call, sometimes on the second call, but I always ask them related to what the income is actually of the CEO. And I feel like it's a really interesting question to ask, and I've only been shut down once from it. The guy just said, it's none of your business. And I think that's a really interesting piece. So I ask people all of these questions. I ask the CEOs their income, because when I know their income, I understand how profitable the business is for them. And then I can really poke into the problems that exist. So I was working with someone. They have a $50 million a year business, and the CEO makes $100,000 a year. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want a $50 million a year business and payroll on my shoulders and only make $100,000. I mean, that's just silly. So the conversation quickly turned to him with why? Why have you made these decisions in your business? And he came up with reasons and talked about low profitability. And then that immediately pushed the conversation into what are the direct-to-consumer middleman removing products or services that we can sell that'll build a lot of profit in the business so that you can take more out because you're working so hard. That got his emotional buy-in. So it's kind of a choose-your-own-adventure. I think there's definitely an art to it. When people say something, I just start digging in deeper and deeper and asking more questions. And sometimes I go down the wrong path. I go down a path, and when I get to the end of it, I'm like, oh, I guess that really wasn't relevant. So then I back up a little bit and I say, okay, Kira, when you said this, when you said your question about yada yada, let's unpack that a bit. What did you mean by that? Or what do you mean your competition is outpacing you in this product niche? And get a better understanding of those things. And I'm writing everything down. As y'all mentioned, Rob, with the DOS process. The DOS process is dangers, opportunities, and strengths. And sometimes I might even ask that question, and this comes from Dan Sullivan. What are the dangers that exist in your business? That might just be a simple question to ask. What are the opportunities and what are your strengths? And whenever someone says something, I'm adding it because they're going to jump around on the call and it's kind of a safe place for them to emote and tell me about their business. They might say, you know, I'm really frustrated about this. Oh, by the way, I've got this new product that we're working on, but hey, I'm really frustrated about this thing. So I have a couple dangers there, plus I throw in the opportunity. And then once they kind of tell me enough information, I can say, okay, based on these things that you said, these are the top opportunities that I'm seeing. Do you agree that these are the top ones? And they'll say yes or no, and we'll get some more clarity there. So it's a lot of guessing and poking and just kind of an art to probing the business to figure out where I can be the most useful. But what I think is so great about that approach is I'm not going there selling one service. I'm there selling them their future success. And I'm figuring out where I fit in. So I'm doing a little business planning for them instead of saying, I'm just a copywriter that's going to sell you on a sales letter. Because they may not need a sales letter. They may need something bigger. And then I can provide those services by bringing in other vendors, which increases my value.
I love that advice. So many writers get a client that approaches them and says, hey, I need a website or I need a brochure or whatever that piece of copy is. And what they really don't need is copy. What they need is copy that helps solve a business problem. And you know, the advice and how you walk through that conversation with the customer really drills into where we can offer the most value. So I really love that. So then the rubber hits the road. How do you turn all of that information into a proposal that the client wants to say yes to?
Great question. So I don't believe in RFPs and in putting proposals out and being a proposal in a stack of proposals. When I was teaching at Tulane, one of the students brought this really serious concern up to me. She said, I'm in a sorority. I kind of look like all of the other girls in my sorority. I'm towards the top in the GPA, but I'm not a 4.0 student. I come from a similar, you know, socioeconomic class of everyone else. And there's this great new role at this great fashion business in fashion merchandising. And I want to be in it. I want that job. How do I get that job? Well, on paper, she can't win because the only thing that she's differentiated by is her grades, and they're lower than some other people's. So by definition, she's going to lose. That's a game she can't win. Similarly, I can't win by putting together a proposal kind of sight unseen with the client, not really talking to them, not figuring out who they are and their emotions and the real problems behind everything and really what they're looking for and all that. I just can't. It's going to be impossible. So my advice to her, which is my advice to the copywriters that are listening to this, is don't compete on paper. I get verbal closes. For me, a cover letter for a resume, that is something that you have to do once the job's been verbally given to you. I wouldn't write cover letters and just send out 25 of them if I was looking for a job. I'd go get a job and then do the formality of filling out a cover letter for that one job. So I'd go sell. So in that situation, I sell people on the call and I have them repeat back kind of active listen what I active listen them. And I say, these are the top priorities that you want to solve. These are the ideas. And I'd like to put together a proposal on that. Does that sound like if I achieve those outcomes, you'd be happy? They're like, absolutely. That would be perfect. No one else is walking them through a proposal at that level. And because of that, I get that verbal close. I get that yes on the call. And I know that that yes is like a 90% yes. You know, I'm not going to like pop the champagne yet, but pretty close. So then I fill out the proposal and I follow up and I continue to follow up. And, you know, that's something that maybe we want to unpack a bit is the follow-up process. But I finally get that close. The email that I send them is saying, hey, Kira, when we talked about these things and you mentioned that if those were solved, it would move the needle in this way and this would be the impact on the business. Here's what I'm going to provide and here's why it's the right thing to do and here's the next steps. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that gets executed and I win the contract.
Okay, yeah, I want to dig into all of that because it's extremely relevant to all the copywriters listening. So when you're closing it on the call or in person, at that point, have you discussed rates? Are you talking money? I know that's always kind of a sticky subject for copywriters.
Yeah, so it takes courage to talk money on the call. So if anyone is familiar with StrengthsFinder, one of my strengths is woo, which is winning others over. It's a great strength, but the shadow side is sometimes I withhold information in order to like make people like me. So I know that that's a weakness that I have. And I know that on the call, I can paint this beautiful picture of this like wonderful future that these people will have working with me. And if I just remove the money part of it, it's like a fairy tale, right? Everyone feels great. But that's not the right way to solve the problem. I do talk money. And one of the ways that I've been able to do that really effectively is having a qualifier on the front end, qualify calls before I talk to someone. You can qualify in a few different ways. So if I go to Genius Network and I'm out there, and that's Joe Polish's organization. If I'm out there and I'm prospecting and I meet someone, I just know that they have the budget. I think that's my assumption. And I'm right most of the time, because if you can afford a $25,000 a year mastermind, you can probably afford an initial kind of like date that we have together as far as work's concerned. I'm not going to sell a year-long contract with someone to get started. I might sell a single piece of copy, I guess would be the equivalent. And I just know that they have the cash for it. So there's that assumption that you can have, depending on the audience that you have. If I don't know the person, maybe they came in from a referral. Was the referring source in the relationship one where they have the propensity to pay me my rate? Yes or no? And I can have that conversation. I love working with people that are more affluent. And I think copywriters will like that as well because they can afford more services and they can afford to spend more on better, you know, contractors. If I don't have that and I have a cold lead that comes in, I have someone on my team that qualifies. And he has a phone call and says, hey, just got your information. I saw the request. Just want to get some more information from you real quick. And they're asking 3 major questions. Do you have the budget? Do you have a reasonable expectation on delivery? And are you a nice enough person to do business with? Those are the 3 questions that they ask. And then they pitch them over to me only if they're yeses. So that's nice. And if you don't have someone to do that, maybe your spouse could do that. Maybe you could just find someone online for, you know, $10, $15 an hour. It's not like a really difficult task to do. That saves you from having that immediate conversation. Another way to do it is through a web form. You know, you could ask people what they've spent previously on marketing. That'll give you an idea of their risk tolerance with marketing and what they look at, how they look at marketing in their business. And then finally, on the call, I'll say, okay, based on our conversation here, this looks like it's probably going to clock in around about 50 hours, which is about 10 grand, a little less than 10 grand. Just give me a quick gut check. Does that sound like something that we'll move forward with or not? And they say yes or no. And I say, if they say no, I say, I totally get it. Hopefully I've given you enough value. I'll follow up with a recap on your next steps without me. And when you have the budget to do something like this, we can move forward. I can't at the beginning of a call really suss out what the budget needs to be because I don't even know what their problem is. Does that make sense?
Totally makes sense. Then you've got the proposal, you've had that initial conversation, you've done some, you know, work around qualifying them. What does the follow-up process look like?
I am a bird dog. Like I follow up. That's a strength that I have. It has made me successful. I could do a poor job on the sales calls. And if I kept my follow-up process, I would still do well. A lot of my success is due to getting verbal closes and then making someone commit to their word saying that we're going to work together. Like, so that's part of it. And that's kind of like the morality of the game of business. You know, you said we're going to work together and it's my job to make sure that I hold you up to your word. So I'm going to follow up with you. Also, if I believe in a product or service, I want to chase it. So just this week, I closed my two biggest accounts ever and I've been chasing them since October.
And wow.
So that's 6 months. That's 6 months of following up. And that follow-up might be every 30 days I'm reaching out. Sometimes I send a message. Sometimes I see something and I text a photo of it to them. I see a news article that they're in or something like that, and I just provide value. I'm not saying, hey, do you have money for me yet? No, that's not the conversation because that puts me in a weird place. But I go into a giving position. I have a guy who the sales conversation stalled, and it stalled pretty significantly. And it's kind of one of those back pocket accounts that I could maybe drum up if I need it. But right now I'm pretty maxed out. And I passed him the proposal and it was like hot. Like we were ready to get started. I thought we were going to get started that following Monday and no reply. So I waited a couple days. And then on like Thursday, I sent him a note back. I was like, hey, did you get that proposal? Any questions for me? You know, let's schedule a time to talk on Monday. No reply, no reply, no reply. So then I pulled a tactic of having someone else on the team reach out. Because me being the person to do the work, also following up at some level devalues me. So I had one of the people on the sales team do that. So she's following up and he doesn't reply. So I say, the hell with it. I want to get a yes or a no because that's our job in sales. I don't want to get a maybe. And that's what I'm stuck with right now. I don't know if this is hot or not. And if it's a no, that's fine. If it's a yes, that's fine. It's just the maybes that kill us. So I want to get that binary out of him. So I sent him macaroons. I was living in New Orleans at the time, and it was a holiday. I don't know, some New Orleans-related holiday. It wasn't Mardi Gras by any means, but it was something. And I mailed him a dozen macaroons, and he called me the day that he received them. So that was like a $25 gift that I sent him, and I got him on the phone. And it changed the relationship of, hey, dude, hey, 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 to, oh, my God, Casey, you're so great. Let's talk. And then he reset expectations with me. And he was just busy. So the follow-up process is incredibly important. We say that it takes 8 to 10 touches to close someone with one of these big accounts that I closed this week. I think it was 15 touches, a lot of phone calls.
Wow.
They had to go through a series of funding before they could afford me. And I mean, all sorts of stuff. I hadn't experienced that before. And I could have easily just said, screw them. Like, this is just not going to be an opportunity that's going to close. But I really believe in what they're doing. And I'm like so tickled to be a part of it that I stayed on top of it and kept following up and providing value. You know, at one point I even felt like I was getting taken advantage of. And then I got the clarity from them that no, in fact, you know, they were out at this event and it was last minute and then these things happened and this big deal for them closed. And because of that, they were too busy to give me any work. That clarity helped me really understand where they were in their business instead of assuming that they don't like me or I'm not good enough or, you know, all the other bullshit stories that we tell ourselves when things don't go our way.
I want to shift gears a bit and ask you about your experience working with copywriters, because I know you've worked with various copywriters through your business. So you've seen firsthand what they do, what they don't do. So what do you think separates, you know, the winners from everyone else?
Back in 2013, our tech implementation company, Tech Guys Who Get Marketing, had a project with Gary Bensavenga and Ted Nicholas.
Wow.
And right? And I didn't know who they were. So I'm like on the calls and I listen to the audios again and you just like realize how sloppy you are. Oh, it was bad. What Ben Savanga showed me in like his perfect kind of calmness was all he cared about was the result. And he would test new things and every idea was a good idea. And I came to the table as this, you know, 20-something marketer. And we had some tech people on our team that were on the call as well. And everyone's ideas were valid. All Gary wanted to do was get it deployed, have it make sense and feel right. I think there's like a certain feel to it that he needed. But then after that, it was just testing. And he rewrote the offer a couple times and had no issue rewriting it. He didn't have any ego in his work. He just wanted to have it work. And I thought that was a really great piece. So when I work with copywriters, you know, I'm an MVP guy. So I love doing the least amount of work to give us the highest opportunity to be successful. You know, I worked with a client and we knocked out some copy for her for a physical product related to like in the lice market. And it was a single page and a half of copy, not a whole lot in there, you know, basic story, basic guarantee, not a whole lot of work. I think we knocked it out in maybe an hour and a half. This is by no means deeply researched or anything, but we got it up, got it live, drove ads to it, got a result, realized that we were onto something, and then made the recommendation to afford a great copywriter. But that's me saying having good enough copy up and testing it is a whole lot better than waiting an extra 3 months and getting the best potential copy and then testing that. Being open to testing and not holding yourself to the immediate success or failure of copy is really important. And I think Ben Savanga was a perfect example of that. I mean, although the stories go that his controls, you know, when he would write something, it would be a control immediately. I think online we have the opportunity to test a lot faster. We have a much bigger market potentially to market to. So if we burn 10,000 names out of a list of 2 million, it's not that big of a deal and it can move the business along faster.
Casey, you've written about your own copywriting process for those, you know, test pieces that you do. Will you tell us a little bit about your formula for stepping through how you write copy when you have to do it?
Oh, wow. Y'all dug deep into the That's funny. So the process as it is today is I'm not a great copywriter. I absolutely understand that. And I've actually been fortunate enough to pull in a couple copywriters to help support me. And that's made the world of difference for me because I used to think I should be a jack of all trades. I should be the guy who understands WordPress and membership sites and like a little bit of PHP and definitely some server stuff and, you know, email marketing and like all that stuff. And I think at some level, having a understanding of it all, not necessarily a deep understanding, but being able to get it or being able to talk intelligently about it makes me unique. But it doesn't make me the best. So, you know, my process, it's honestly like creative swiping and getting new ideas from different pieces and poking around on different sites when I'm just not feeling the muse to write and laying out something that could work and getting a couple radically different ideas tested. So, you know, how do I identify the hook? To me, it's always emotional. That's always what I'm looking for is the emotion that makes the person take action. I have a avatar document that I use. And I rewrote kind of the traditional avatar document because I want more open-ended questions for my clients to work on. And what I ask is head, heart, and home. So I say, what's in the head of this avatar? What's the negative thing? What do they say to themselves at night before they go to bed? What do they say in the shower? What do they say in the drive to work? What do they say in the heat of the moment when they're so frustrated with whatever the problem is? What are those words? And maybe we go on Amazon and we look at book reviews and say, I was feeling this way until I read this book and now I feel this way. And we're pulling in that actual language that they use. All that head information is incredibly important. And then I say, what's in their heart? What are they longing for? Are they looking forward to like this future? And we paint that picture really clearly. And then finally their home, which is what's their physical makeup? What kind of car do they drive? How old are they? Do they have kids? Private school, public school? What's their job? What's their income? Is it dual income? Those kind of questions. And from there, I'm able to write copy as if I was emotionally talking to someone and kind of encouraging them to take action based on a pain. I don't have a great formula for writing headlines. I don't have a great formula for writing copy. And this is my quick start. So I'm a 9 on the quick start and a 1 on the follow through. So I just go and I get something out and done as quickly as possible. And it's good. It's not great. And I can get results from it. And then I can refine it either through testing or through just hiring a better copywriter.
I want to know how copywriters can think bigger You know, what opportunities are we just missing out on because we're so focused on, you know, that one thing we do, right? Like I write a sales page, that's what I do. And then maybe I'm missing out on this whole other opportunity with new clients, current clients. Have you noticed anything there?
Sure. So there's a couple things. One is the futurist stuff. I've been so lucky to work with Peter Diamandis and see his work Ooh. With his book launch, Abundance and Bold. Our tech team actually did the launch for it. I actually wrote the copy for the whole boldbook.com site.
Whoa, so if you very cool.
go to the Wayback Machine and look at Bold Book back when it launched, I wrote that copy and then Tom on our team wrote or did all the design work. So that was a really fun project and it was effective. I know it could have been better, but it was, you know, it was as good as I could do at the time. I feel so self-conscious talking to copywriters because they're going to like poke a hole in my stuff and say, oh, this isn't right. And they're right. There's a better way to do it. But I'll just say that I did it and having it done is a whole lot better than having it right and not done. I think the future stuff is really important. And what you should know, you know, in the game that you should play. And if you have kids or nieces and nephews or just friends, you know, have drinks with the kids if you want or with your friends or whatever and have a conversation around what's going to happen and just play it out and just exercise that part of your brain. What's going to happen? I'm moving to Pittsburgh in a month. And in Pittsburgh, that's where those self-driving Ubers are. And there's a road that I can go on. And you know, that's the highest chance that I'll have to pick up an Uber that has that's a self-driving Uber. But what does that mean when we have a self-driving car? How does that change things? And I think that's the starting point. So play the game. How does that change things? Well, if we have a self-driving car, we probably don't need a driver in it. Like obviously, right? So we'll get rid of them. So we're going to have more unemployment. Okay, that's interesting. These rides are going to be safer. So that's going to reduce the accident frequency, which is actually going to reduce the available organs for transplants. Okay, that's weird. All right. But then what else is going to happen? We're going to see probably reduced car insurance fees. What does that mean for the car insurance market? Okay, if these engines get more, you know, if we look at Tesla, it's going to have a frunk. It's going to have a front trunk. What does that mean? So I have more storage capacity in this sporty car. Why not outfit it with some cooling device and send my car to get groceries while I'm at work at the office? Wait, do I even need a car now? You know, like you start going through all these what ifs around what's going to happen with technology. And it really changes the businesses that we need to be building. If you're building a business just based on the short conversation around, you know, you're helping someone in insurance sales, well, we're going to live longer. Like I have a commitment to live to 153. So I have a long time left to go. What's going to happen to my net worth, you know, after age 95? What is compound interest really going to look like? It's really a fascinating conversation. And if we don't live through it, because maybe, you know, someone listening to this doesn't opt into the idea of human longevity, listen, your kids or your grandkids are going to have that opportunity. And it's going to be expensive. And my joke on my Instagram is I'm working hard enough to buy a ticket to Mars because I really think that we can buy a ticket to Mars if we want. And what would we do there and all that kind of stuff. But the world is changing. And if you're in a traditional business, you're going to lose. And that means that copywriting is more necessary than ever because there's more noise in the marketplace. There's more charlatans and bullshit. It's more expensive to mail. I mean, it's so expensive to mail a postcard. It's so expensive to mail a first-class piece of mail. So it has to be more effective. So you have to have a good copywriter. It's like a necessity. If you have a bad copywriter, you might as well burn the money. Looking at these things and seeing the value of this role, I think is incredibly important. So I think future's huge. And if you want education there, go back and listen to all of the episodes of 10xtalks.com. That's Dan Sullivan from Strategic Coach and Peter Diamandis. And it's awesome. You'll hear about human longevity and robotics and all this stuff. And you don't need to be a science nerd to just be tuned into the fact that this stuff is coming. And if you fail, you might be able to retire as a copywriter without heeding this advice. But your kids won't. And if your kids are like, hey, I'm going to do what mom or dad did, they're going to be screwed unless they heed the advice and look for ways to you know, dig into an exponential market.
Wow. Interesting stuff. Casey, I want to ask about a story that you have on your about page. A lot of writers, when they're working with a client, you know, they'll provide them with a first draft or with their recommendations and the client will come back and say, you know, no, it needs to change and do all these things against the recommendation of the copywriter. You've got a great story that you've shared about how you stood up for, you know, your recommendations and actually, at least in the short term, lost the client. Will you tell us that story and what you learned from, you know, standing up for what you believe?
Oh, that's awesome that you read that. The notion was that this client, great client and friend, just like really good people. I love them so much. And that's almost a problem in business, is to like be such good friends with these people, you know, be such good friends with your client that you can't be objective.
Yeah.
But they came to me and said, hey, Casey, we're going to go do this thing. And they hired this marketing company, and it was uber expensive what they were buying. And I could quickly see what was going on. Like, I've put together packages like that. Like, I know what the labor is involved. And it was this convoluted funnel. I mean, there was more downsells to the upsells to the downsells than I've ever seen before. I just knew that it was not going to be a winner, and it was way too expensive, and that money should just be put instead to the things that are working. You know, they're limiting our campaigns on things that are working or showing promise, and they're instead saying, I'm going to, you know, take this big chunk of cash and I'm going to go spend it on this thing. So I kind of pleaded with them. I was like, don't. This is a really bad idea, and I don't want your business. Like, take your business somewhere else, but don't make this decision. It's going to set you back. It's going to really hurt. They said, you know what? We think it's the right thing. We've heard from other people. We heard from this guru that it's the right thing. I said, okay, all right. Like, you guys do your thing, but these are the questions that you need to ask them, and this is the way that you can ensure that you're not going to get screwed. They got the thing that they purchased, and the deliverables were okay, and the results were poor. The cost per lead was 25x what our cost per lead was, with around the same propensity for a purchase of their product. It was a total failure. So they came back to me, and I didn't even start the conversation, but I took some distance from them, because my relationship with them was, I'm your trusted advisor. I'm going to make sure you do the right thing. I'm going to come out. I'm going to celebrate your kid's birthday. I'm going to, you know, go to your event. Like, I'm going to be there for you. And then they didn't trust me. So it's like, okay, like, maybe this redefines our relationship. I stepped back a little bit. They came back to me and they said, Casey, it didn't work. The numbers came in below even what you estimated at. We made a huge mistake and we screwed up. I was like, I didn't want you guys to screw up, but I appreciate you saying that. And they're like, yeah. So, you know, what you say is what we'll believe moving forward. So that put more responsibility on my shoulders, but it also like strengthened the relationship that I had with them. Now, when I say something, it doesn't get questioned, which is really important, right? If we want to be effective, I don't need to defend what I'm saying all the time.
Casey, you know, we've talked a lot about the sales process and, you know, the importance of following up. A lot of our copywriters, you know, they're new to business and they're just having a hard time even getting on a call, period. So how can we market ourselves today, you know, while also being aware of the future and what's coming? But if I just want to get myself out there and stand out from all of the other copywriters out there, do you have any baby steps or action steps I can take this week?
Yeah. So the first one is specialize. Specialize in your niche. Specialize in an experience that you've had. I should be arrested the next time I agree to write copy for women's weight loss product. Right? Like, I have no business writing that. Sure, I can write it reasonably well, but I don't really know how these women feel. So if you're a woman who's lost 50 pounds or more, you'd do a really great job of being able to emotionally write to other women that want to lose that kind of weight. So specializing in that niche, I think, is huge. If you have a connection with a specific industry or niche, do that. For me, you know, it's health and fitness. Those are the things that I really love. Futuristic stuff too. And I think also that there's a huge market in the cannabis business. I think we're just going to see that explode.
Yes.
So yeah. Specializing is important. Once you specialize, fly a flag that says that this is what you do. And yeah, you can do other stuff. Yeah, I love health and fitness products, but some of the stuff that I'm working on isn't health and fitness related. That's okay. I'm still good at it. I might be the best at it, but someone else could come in and probably stomp me pretty quickly because they get the market better than I do. But specializing is better. So specialize first, fly a flag that say that you're the specialist, and then go reach out to people. And don't say, hey, I'm the copywriter who can write to everybody about any problem. Say, I'm really, really great at this. And if you have other work, yeah, I can support you. But listen, where I'm going to shine and where your dollars are going to turn into Benjamins is when you hire me to write this type of copy. Turn down the clients that are a bad fit immediately. I can't tell you how many frustrating clients I've held on to when I should have let them go. You know, you let them go and you be a stand-up person and you refund them as necessary and you don't create, you know, ill will, but yeah, you got to drop that stuff quick. So those are two things. And then the next is go get in that space. Go get out there and do something that's unique. I love gifts. I think gifts are a great way to get you in front of your right audience. You get attention that way. It's a gift that keeps on giving. So one example is back in 2013, I went to Titans of Direct Response, Brian Kurtz's big event where he had all the Titans. You know, that's really where I got to see how just incredible Ben Savanga was and all that. And it was amazing to go. I could barely afford to go. I was really like scraping together a check that I had just received the day before the last day for payments. And I was able to get out there, and it really changed everything for me. And what I did was I knew I was just going to be a nobody. You know, I'm just going to be one of the people in the room. I'm not one of the greats in marketing or in copywriting. So I'm going to get passed over. So either I effectively hustle the room and try to meet people and like research the name of all the people that are going to be at the event and have great conversations and say, oh, hey, you're this person. I'm this guy. Like, let's talk about this thing and really try to push it, which I did do. I also thought, what could I do to get attention while having fun and being really like authentically me? So I heard last minute that Joe Polish booked his ticket late to Brian Kurtz's event. I didn't really have much of a relationship with Joe. I mean, we had worked together on a project here or there through our tech company. And Joe knew of me, but I don't think he knew much about who I was or anything. I don't think he could pick me out of a crowd. I heard that Joe was last minute booking a room. No rooms were available the first night. So he asked Brian if he could stay with him the first night. So Brian's hosting this huge event, like Brian's opus, and Joe's going to like crash in his bedroom. So I reach out online and I find a caricature artist. And I get this fantastic caricature of Brian and Joe in a bathtub together. And just sit on the bottom, bathtub mastermind. And I put it on Facebook and I tagged both of them in it. And that image, it cost me $40. $40. That image has been in front of the Genius Network meetings multiple times. Brian's used it on Facebook, always tags me. I mean, it's a funny thing to do and it lasts. So yeah, I could have gone out and bought dinner for a bunch of people and spent $1,000 or $2,000 on dinner. But instead, I spent $40 on a gift that kept on giving, and no one's going to forget it. So consider that. Consider the atypical things. I really like to look at families too. If an entrepreneur is successful and you want to get their attention and you hear that they have a family, don't send them the traditional thing, which would be like a cigar or something boring like that. Send them a board game to play with their family. Say, hey, I love playing this with my kids. I thought you'd dig it too. Looking forward to having a deeper relationship as the years go on. Those kind of things. People don't forget it. I think it's a big deal. I mean, even Paris, I got to know Paris Lymphropoulos through a couple different events. And I was like, this is a guy I really want to be friends with. Well, I find out from his daughter that Paris hates board games, like just loathes them. So I mailed him a board game for Christmas. And he sends me a text message like, why the hell would you send me this thing? And for me, it was like the perfect thing. It was, you know, $30. And it's one of those anchors in the relationship that, you know, are measurable and unique. So those are ways that I would get into relationships instead of just trying to, you know, compete in the traditional way. So again, this goes back to that notion of the student who couldn't get that fashion merchandising job. She couldn't compete on paper. I don't want to compete really in a room of people. So what I want to do is I want to set myself up for success by having a better follow-up, by approaching people in a unique way, and by offering a specific, measurable, clear value that when someone reads it, they're like, oh, yeah, I get it. I get what you do. And I don't need you, but my friend does. So let me make an introduction, you know, that kind of thing.
I can think of, you know, other questions I'd love to ask you around, you know, avoiding being a commodity. So many writers deal with that. We've sort of danced around that quite a bit, but we're running out of time. And I want to ask one last question because I think it gets maybe to who you are, Casey. And that is, tell us about city dating and what you're doing.
Okay. So 12 months ago, my fiance and I sold all of our stuff. We were living in New Orleans and I took a break from teaching at Tulane and we got a Durango and threw our dog in the back seat, and we have a small storage unit in Alabama with like our bed and some art and my banjo. And we hit the road full time. And the thought was, we're looking for a new city to live in. So we're going to spend 2 years on the road dating cities. And we go and find furnished apartments in a city that we consider is a potential great city for us. And we stick around there for 60 days, 90 days, play around, see if we like it, see if we like the community. And so far, so good. We've done Toronto and Nashville. We've got Pittsburgh. We're going to do, we spend time with family every summer and every winter. So we get to maximize our time with all the kids in our family, which I think is really important. And, you know, that's another piece of this, which is I read an article that said most adults spend 3 to 5 days a year with their parents when they're in their 30s. And I thought that was pretty unacceptable. So we made a commitment to spend at least 60 days a year with our parents. So we're creating a lifestyle that allows us to do the things that are most important to us. And I think that distance from work also gives us the opportunity to be more creative at work and not be stuck in the same old every day.
Any favorite cities so far? Are you feeling love towards any of them that you might commit to when your 2 years is up?
It's like a constant conversation. So we were going to be in Austin right now, and then the lodging fell through. So we're going to Pittsburgh, and I want Pittsburgh to be great. I really think it has the opportunity. It's great and close to family on both sides. I'm from Michigan. She's from Alabama. But then there's Austin, and I think Austin could be great. And then there's Seattle. Yeah, no real commitment yet, but it's really fun to operate a business. You know, like my computer, I got a virus back in January. My computer was offline for maybe 3 hours as I formatted it and came back clean. All of my stuff's in the cloud. I'm so mobile. I'm so agile in my business. If my computer got stolen, if our car got stolen, everything got stolen, you know, it wouldn't take us long to get back on our feet because we live in this way that's like really flexible. And I think it's just been a great lesson.
Wow. Well, Casey, this has been really fascinating. And, you know, we want to give our listeners a place to go if they want to find out more about you. So where should they go?
Sure. So our website, the Tech Guys website, is techguys.co or techguyswhogetmarketing.com. And my personal site is caseystanton.com, caseystanton.com. I spend a lot of time on Instagram and on Facebook too. So if you all have any questions, you're welcome to, you know, ping me on Facebook. Love to help point you in the right direction.
And Casey will have to pull you into the Facebook group.
Oh, yeah.
So you can join the party in there.
Sure. Yeah, and I'll also be happy to pass on that proposal that I shared with the Titans group.
Oh, awesome. That would be incredible.
That's great.
Templated proposal that others can use. And it has, you know, the basic legalese that you'll run by a lawyer, obviously, but it's got essentially the bones of what I use for proposals.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Happy to help. Well, thank you all so much for having me on. This has been a lot of fun.
Before we end the podcast, we just want to tell you about our sponsor, AirStory. AirStory is an application designed to help you write faster. And it does a few things really well. It makes collaborating with others on your team easier. So if you work with clients or other team members on projects, you'll love the way that you can interact within your project documents. But there are two things that we really like about AirStory that you won't get with Word or Google Docs. The first is the way that it lets you organize information into cards. If you refer to research or other information when writing blog posts or websites or sales pages, you'll love the way that you can organize bits of information or entire articles into a card file that you can then drag and drop into your document. And if you do your research online, AirStory's Chrome extension lets you cut and save information directly into AirStory. It's pretty cool. Plus, AirStory has a library of templates that you can use on different projects. So let's say you've been hired to write a sales page or an email sequence and you don't have any experience or you want additional inspiration for the project. You can go into the template library, find a template for what you're working on, and use it to start your document. Maybe best of all, you can try it now for free. In fact, one project at AirStory is always free. If you're a professional writer, there's so much here that can help you. Check it out at airstory.co/club. You've been listening to the Copywriter Club podcast with Kira Hug and Rob Marsh. Music for the show is a clip from Gravity by Whitest Boy Alive, available in iTunes. If you like what you've heard, you can help us spread the word by subscribing in iTunes and by leaving a review. For show notes, a full transcript, and links to our free Facebook community, visit thecopywriterclub.com. We'll see you next episode.